Welcome to Open Line with Fred Anderle from WOSU Public Media, an intelligent and balanced discussion on a wide variety of topics.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. This hour on the program, is the American healthcare system falling apart? Well, my guest this hour, journalist Jonathan Cohn, says it is. He notes there are about 45 million Americans without any health insurance today. Even those who are covered may find that their policies do not cover all that they were led to believe. Their HMO could deny critical care. Even their health insurance provider may be owned by scam artists. That's not unheard of. You not get paid anything at all. Many Americans who are self-employed find it difficult to buy a single policy for themselves, either because the monthly premium is so expensive or because private insurers may not be willing to cover them at all. Many small businesses can no longer afford group health insurance rates. Large companies are complaining about health policy costs. And my guest says that if we think that those who have no health insurance are adequately treated at hospital emergency rooms or under the Medicaid program for the poor, he says there are big problems with those assumptions. Jonathan Cohn says that the consequences of a broken healthcare system may not be immediately visible to those of us lucky enough to have a Cadillac policy through our jobs. So he would like to introduce us to some of our fellow Americans who fell between the cracks of an incomplete healthcare system with consequences both financial and life-threatening, in some cases fatal. We'll learn more this hour. Jonathan Cohn is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine and contributing editor at the American Prospect. His new book is entitled Sick. It's subtitled The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Welcome to Open Line, Jonathan Cohn. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
And after we lay some groundwork here, 614-292-8513. Jonathan, I was struck that not only, of course, are there those among the poor, or the working poor, who are not covered, but those of us who may think of ourselves as middle class, and we may think we have a policy that covers us in terms of a difficult and complex and expensive illness, in some cases may not be covered at all, huh?
That's right. That's right. I mean, there is what you call uninsurance, which means you don't have insurance. Then there's underinsurance, which means you have insurance, but it doesn't cover what you want. And that can happen all the time. It can happen, as you say, because it turns out your insurance is fraudulent, obviously. But another issue is that it could turn out that your insurance doesn't cover the particular disease, treatment for the particular disease you have. There's a story in my book about a woman whose son is born prematurely, and he ends up with cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And now her husband, she lives in Austin, Texas. She's living in one of the nicer suburbs of Austin, Texas. Her husband's on the fast track at the local bank. They're doing very well. They have a new home. He has terrific health insurance, or so they think. And then when all the doctors recommend that she get physical therapy for her son, the insurance company, which is like most people's insurance today, is managed care, says, no, we won't cover it. And she goes through endless battles with them. It's one thing after another. First is that, well, they'll only cover 30 days, then they'll cover 60 days. Then a company says, well, we'll only cover rehabilitative services. And since your son hasn't actually walked yet, that's considered habilitative services. And she goes through all of this, and she ends up trying to, she talks to lawyers, she talks to the government. And at the end of the day, she does get the therapy for her son. She's a very determined woman, and he does end up walking, by the way. I met him. He's doing well. But along the way, what she has to sacrifice is this, well, she and her husband basically have to pay out of pocket for this. Mm-hmm. They end up giving up their dream house, living in a mobile home. Eventually, they end up divorced. And of course, you know, like any divorce, this one has many causes. But I think there's no question that the stress of dealing with the money and the insurance company, they both say, was the leading factor in what probably in the end drove them apart. And that's just one example. Things like that.
I was
going to
say, if she hadn't been as persistent as she was, enormously persistent, she wouldn't have gotten covered.
Well, that's right. And there are people who don't get covered. I mean, that's sort of the point of the story. I mean, she was a rare, she's incredibly energetic and persistent. And that's what it took. I mean, it took someone who was willing to break all the rules and to give up almost everything to get this treatment for her son. And you have to ask yourself, well, if your health insurance isn't there when you're having this kind of catastrophic need, well, what is it there for? What kind of system is it where somebody who is doing what they think are all the right things, and again, her husband has a very good paying job, she ends up getting a second job, they're doing all the right things, she's taking care of the kids, they're playing by the rules, as they like to say. Mm-hmm. And yet here they are, sorry, you know, they need this for their son, but sorry, the insurance won't pay for it. Well, if they don't have insurance, Well, how can any of us expect to be covered in a situation like that?
Will you take us back to the days of the old Blue Cross when it was organized for a public purpose, and it wasn't just a for-profit situation. In fact, it was nonprofit. Their taxes were forgiven, right? And they had what you call community rates. Everybody was charged the same, is that right?
That's right. When the American health insurance began really in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and the original, what we would now consider modern health insurance plans, were the early Blue Cross plans. Now, the Blue Cross plans, interestingly enough, they were started by the hospitals. Hospitals needed insurance because prior to the invention of health insurance, they had a lot of patients who couldn't pay their bills. And it was the hospitals who came up with this idea of selling insurance to groups of people around whom you could get lots of contributions. And the idea is that in any large group of people, only a few people are sick. So as long as you have a large group, you'll have enough money to cover those expenses for those few people with really big medical bills. Now, Blue Cross, though, precisely because it was chartered by the hospitals and its job was to fill the hospitals with paying patients, it tried to expand enrollment as much as it could. So it was glad to offer insurance to anybody. As long as it had these large groups that it was relying on, it knew that it had enough contributions from healthy people to cover the cost of the sick. And so if you came to them and said, yes, I want insurance, but I have a pre-existing condition of some sort, they didn't look askance at you, they didn't turn you away, they didn't charge you more, they took you anyway. Everybody paid the same rate. And in effect, the idea was we're all in this together, and we should all pay into this common pool. Now, it never worked perfectly, and lots of people were left out of the system, but it worked pretty well. But over time, commercial insurance companies started to get into the business, and they realized that, well, if we insure only the healthy people, only the people who don't have serious medical conditions, well, then we can charge less. We can steal away those customers and make more money. Now, that was great for those insurance companies, but, of course, it pretty much meant Blue Cross was in trouble because now Blue Cross is left with all of these very sick people. So Blue Cross eventually had to abandon its open-ended policies, and that is why today, that's a big reason why today, if you are trying to buy insurance on your own as opposed to through an employer, and you have a pre-existing condition, you're going to have a very hard time getting it.
Mm-hmm. Do we know in terms of the denial of insurance coverage for individual policies, do we know by what percentage approximately they get denied of all those people who go for an individual policy?
There are a lot of different figures out there, and the insurance industry has one set of figures. Others looking at it has another set of figures. It's not at all unreasonable to suggest that as many as a quarter of the people applying for health insurance cannot get what you would consider a clean offer. And by a clean offer, I mean an offer of insurance at a reasonable rate that will cover everything. Now, there are insurance companies that will tell you, well, we don't mind. We'll insure you if you have, say, diabetes. What they won't tell you up front is that if they insure you and you have diabetes, they won't cover anything related to your diabetes. In fact, This happens to a woman in my book. She is self-employed, very successful, but she's diabetic. And she has to go buy insurance on her own, and she can't find it. The only policies offered to her are from insurers who say, we will cover everything but your diabetes. And, of course, she's smart. She figures it out. Well, gee, can't almost anything I have be blamed on my diabetes? And if that's the case, why do I bother even buying the insurance? And she ends up going without insurance for a while because I think rationally she figures, this isn't going to help me. What's going to happen is I'm going to pay these premiums. I'm going to get a medical bill. I'll be stuck with that medical bill, and then I'll have less money to pay it.
So this is Janice Ramsey, the realtor from Central Florida, right?
That's right.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, they're going to blame anything on the diabetes. But finally, she found what she thought was a good insurance company that would cover her, huh?
Yes, she did. She thought she found a good insurance company, and she was very excited. You know, they had very professional-looking literature. They said they had all the right certificates, and they were hooked into the best doctors in Central Florida, and she was just thrilled. So she signs up for it, and they start taking her premiums every month, as she agrees to let them do. And everything seems fine for about a year, and then one day she starts getting calls from a hospital where she had to have the procedure, and they begin to say, well, you know, we haven't been paid. And she thinks, well, that's odd. So she calls the insurer, and they say, oh, yes, we're just reviewing the claim. And she thinks, well, that's fine. That's what insurance companies do. So she lets it go a little longer, and again she gets the call from the hospital, and again she calls the insurer, and finally collection agencies start to call. So she finally decides to bring the state authorities in, and she calls the state. She said, I have a problem. My insurance company won't pay my bills. And the state has to break the news to her that, well, no, actually your problem is that you have been taken in by an unlicensed insurer that's basically a scam, and you've been paying all this money, but you have no insurance at all. And so suddenly now she's really in the worst of all worlds because, first of all, she owes this mountain of medical debt. And this is a woman who's never missed a credit payment in her life, apparently. I mean, she's got a perfect sterling credit rating, very smart businesswoman. And here she is. She's got collection agencies calling over $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in debt. And meanwhile, of course, more important, more immediately, she's got no insurance again. She's got medical problems. And so she does what a lot of people end up doing, and she skimps on her care, and she doesn't get the regular care for her diabetes, and she ends up running even more medical bills as she gets complications and such.
Yeah. Tell me how these scam artists operate. In other words, we always thought, well, gee, if you call the Ohio Department of Insurance, they're going to take care of any problem that arises, but they can't, right?
Right, right. Well, that's the problem. I mean, there's a very complicated regulatory scheme. And again, this is one of the, you know, if I could take a step back for a second, you know, people sometimes ask, you know, we talk about the American healthcare system and we talk about it in terms of what it does to people who don't have health insurance and the hardship, the people in my book. But of course, one of the stranger things is it's just so darn complicated. No other country has a system like ours with so many conflicting regulations and conflicting different insurance companies. And this is a symptom of it. You know, the states aren't sure who they're supposed to regulate, who they're not. The federal government doesn't always make it clear who they're supposed to regulate. And so what ends up happening is these scam artists, they find the little wedges, they find the little holes, they see a place where they can operate for a while and nobody will watch what they're doing, and they steal a few bucks. I mean, this has been going on. You can go back to the 1940s. There were examples like this when there were scam artists preying on people, and they always prey on the same people. They find the spot in the workforce where there are people who have money, who are hardworking, who want to buy health insurance but can't find it because they know these people are desperate. People like Janice Ramsey, people who are not poor, people who think they're doing all the right things and they're just desperate to find some coverage somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I remember you mentioned there was a scam artist that hooked up with the National Writers Union. That's a union for writers where you could purchase health insurance. You could have been a member of that. As a writer, I could have been a member of that. We might have bought that health insurance and it was phony.
Right. Well, that's the thing. The other thing they do is they either hook up with legitimate organizations or they invent their own. There was one that masqueraded as a union and had the name that sounded just like a real union. And so they came to you, oh, you thought it was this union. There was another one that had the name of a popular Fidelity. I'll have to double check. But it was the name of a popular investment fund. People said, aha, this is from the investment fund. Well, it wasn't connected to the investment fund, but these people are clever. They say this will make us sound more legitimate.
Vanguard, I think, yeah.
Vanguard, yes. No, I know. I knew it wasn't Fidelity. I couldn't get that name off my brain. But these scam artists are very clever, and they are very good at faking insurance, making themselves look legitimate, making it look like they are the real product. And so people who, you know, don't have weeks and weeks and weeks to spend, and, you know, I mean, who has the time, that, you know, to actually double-check all the phone numbers on the certificates and to call? And a lot of people just wouldn't think to even do this in the first place. You have to be enormously sophisticated to be able to spot one of these scams, and by the time, most people don't, and then by the time they find out, they end up with all this medical debt.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Jonathan Cohn, is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. His new book is called Sick, subtitled The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. We're at 614-292-8513. But, Jonathan, the problem, as you point out, is much bigger than the scam artist. It's got to do with the system. I guess the managed care system, when it first came in to place, had some pretty high ideals, and the idea was to, you know, cut back on this enormous expenditure for health care nationally, but at the same time get people covered. But it's something very different now.
That's right. Managed care has a very idealistic lineage. It actually goes back all the way to the spirit of rural cooperatives during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, when in farm communities there was a concern that farmers couldn't afford their medical care. And so some people set up co-ops, in effect, and a bunch of people would get together and they would pay into this co-op, a medical co-op, and there would be a group of doctors who would provide these people with any care they needed, and they didn't charge separately for every procedure. It was basically you paid like a monthly fee, and the doctors provided for every care, every need you had. And typically these co-op boards, even they were run democratically in the sense that there would typically be representatives from the community as well as the doctors who sort of oversaw their operations and set the broad parameters of policy. And as the idea evolved, people realized this is actually a very good way to deliver medical care, because when you have what you would call, say, a medical home, there's a lot of consistency to your care. Everybody is talking to each other. And precisely because they're getting this limited infusion of money every month or year or however you pay it, there's an incentive to be efficient about it, but in the best sense of the word, to think about patient care. Well, are we going to give this patient a new drug? Is this drug actually going to help them, or is it just a new fancy drug that someone's trotted out that doesn't really offer a new benefit? And over time, these group practices, as they were called, became real models of some of the best medical care in the country. In fact, even today, in some parts of the country, if you go, for example, to Seattle, Washington, there's an institution there called Group Health of Puget Sound, and very much run in the spirit of those original group practices, and you get excellent care at these places. What happened was that the medical community for a long time fought them, because most of the medical community saw this as a threat to individual autonomy. Doctors are in private practice for the most part at this time. They don't like the idea of these groups. They don't like the idea of not being paid for on a per-service basis. And so the group practices stay isolated in a few places around the country. But in the 1970s, we experienced what's really the first modern crisis of healthcare costs. Healthcare costs are getting so expensive. The government's worried about paying it, and the private sector is starting to worry as well. People say, gee, this managed care seems to provide better care for less money. Let's use that. The problem is that as you go through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there's a debate over how you should use managed care. In fact, the Clinton health care plan envisioned using managed care as a vehicle to get everybody better care and then to save money, the money savings of which would have been used to cover everybody. Instead of that, you basically have the free market just running itself, and the commercial insurance industry ends up kind of hijacking managed care. Now, at the end of the day, managed care does save a lot of money during the 1990s. Anybody who saw their paycheck go up during the 1990s and didn't have to pay as much for their health insurance in that sense benefited from managed care as we were all changed over into these plans. But the way they saved money wasn't always in the best interest of patients. Not only were there times when people with really severe medical needs couldn't get the care they wanted because insurance companies were simply looking to save a buck, but there really wasn't any push towards greater quality medicine, which had always been the idea of managed care. Again, it was supposed to promote quality and lower cost, and it really just promoted lower cost. And so in that sense, the experiment really never lived up to its billing.
So quality of medicine and low cost was the original situation, but no longer, you're saying.
Yeah.
What about these big HMO corporations that pay their executives enormous, multi-millions of dollars, and they're on the stock market, and tell me about them.
Well, you know, it used to be that when you look at the ownership of managed care and HMOs as late as the 70s and 80s, they were predominantly nonprofit corporations. Now, it's not a given that every nonprofit is going to be more humane or more sensitive to the need of its patients than for-profits. But in general, I think it is fair to say that for-profit corporations exist to serve their shareholders. They exist to generate profits, and they exist to find new ways of making money. And this is really a theme not just for managed care, but for our entire healthcare system. The fundamental problem with our healthcare system is that you really don't make money financing healthcare for sick people because they need a lot of medical care. It gets very expensive to take care of all those people. Insurance companies can always, it's always easier for them to make money by avoiding the sick people as opposed to actually providing good care to their beneficiaries. And so you have this situation where you have these for-profit corporations, which are run with a for-profit mentality. So they're delivering shareholder money for their shareholders. They are paying their executives these very lavish sums. And meanwhile, a lot of times their patients aren't getting the care they need. And I think the best indicator of this is something that is called in the insurance business. This is called the medical loss ratio. If you study healthcare, if you talk to people in the health business, you'll hear over and over again, medical loss ratio. Now, medical loss ratio tells you the amount of money that an insurance company uses that goes into actual patient care. And I think it's very, very telling, in fact, that in the parlance of the business, the loss, quote-unquote, the money that is lost by the insurance company is the money that's actually spent on healthcare as opposed to overhead. But the commercial insurance companies in general, their medical loss ratio tends to be at 70, 60, 80%. In other words, that's saying that 60 to 80% of the money that they take in actually goes back out to purchase care for their beneficiaries. Well, nonprofits tend to be at 90%. So you're saying that the nonprofits, they tend to be $9 of $10. $9 out of every 10 is going to patient care. And of course, government-run systems like Medicare are up at 97%, and you want that number to be high. So it's really quite astounding to say that for some of these commercial insurance companies, 3 or 4 out of every $10 that goes in as premiums goes back out as profit. It goes to overhead. that goes to compensating these executives. And, you know, speaking for myself, I would like to think that if I'm paying all this money for my health insurance, then most of it was coming back to take care of me or somebody else who was a subscriber.
Sure. You also point out that if we think that as a kind of place of last resort, that people who have no money at all, who may go to work every day, but their employer can't afford health coverage and they can't afford to buy their own individual policy, if we think that going to a hospital, an emergency room is going to get them care, we have to think about this in another way.
Right. Well, that's the great myth of one of the great myths about the uninsured is that, well, oh, everybody will get the health care they need eventually. And there's sort of two problems with that. The first is that it's not true you get the care you need. The law, federal law says that an emergency room cannot turn away somebody who is not in stable condition. So if you show up at the ER and you're bleeding from a gunshot or you're having a heart attack, they have to take you. But if you're not bleeding from a gunshot, if you don't have a heart attack, you may have to wait a very long time, or they don't have to see you at all if it's just for routine care. And, in fact, that's what happens to the uninsured. They don't get the routine care. And study after study after study has shown this. They don't get the tests they need. They don't get the preventative care. And, of course, that ends up boomerang because these are precisely the people who then show up with these really awful, complicated medical problems that haven't been treated for so long. So that's the first part. The second part is that let's say you do get the treatment, you do show up at the ER, you have some kind of emergency and they take care of you. Well, that's not the end of the story. The hospital will expect to get paid typically. Now, some hospitals will let you know that they may have a charity care program or they may try to enroll you in a public program if you're eligible for one. But in many, many cases, what happens is that people end up with these huge debts that they really have no way to pay off in the world. After all, most of the people who are uninsured, almost by definition, they're probably not the most affluent people in society. So how are they going to pay off a $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000 medical debt? I mean, even most middle-class people can't drop that kind of money on a dime. And even if you come up with a payment plan, they tend to be pretty steep. And, of course, you're dealing with collection agencies and such. It's very complicated. And the great, great irony of all this is that people who are uninsured actually end up getting bills that are bigger than people with insurance, because the way our hospital pricing system works is it's a little bit like a car dealer. Hospitals put up their list prices. Now, then the insurance companies come and say, well, we're not going to pay that, you know, for a cardiac treatment, but we won't pay $20,000, we'll pay $10,000. And the hospital says, okay, because, of course, the insurance company is bargaining on behalf of thousands of patients the hospital will see in a year. But somebody who's uninsured doesn't have that person to bargain with them. So they end up paying the full price or getting charged the full price. I like to say it's like walking into a car dealer and paying sticker instead of bargaining down. Everyone knows you're supposed to bargain down, but, you know, imagine if you couldn't bargain down. You had to just go and pay sticker price while everybody else was bargaining down. Mm-hmm. And the difference is that, you know, with a car, maybe it's a difference of $1,000 to $2,000 on an $18,000 car, let's say. Well, with a hospital bill, you're talking about a difference between $10,000 and $40,000 or $20,000 and $60,000. And it's a huge difference. And, of course, again, these are people, well, most people can't pay a $60,000 bill out of their pockets. So, yes, you end up owing these very large medical debts, and then you get collection agencies after you, and then the next thing you know, your credit rating might be ruined, and you might have to declare bankruptcy and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is somebody who goes to work every day. They may make very little money. Their small employer may say, look, I can't afford group rates. I mean, these may be very industrious people who simply get caught in a bad situation.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I mean, one of the reasons I picked the people in the book is I wanted to showcase that. I mean, most of the people in the book, like I say, you know, they play by what most people would consider the rules of American society. They go to work, they have jobs, they try to raise their families. They are doing everything right. They are doing everything you would want them to do. You know, they are doing what we would do, what most of us presumably think we would like to do. These are not lazy people. It is not the case that the uninsured are simply people who are too lazy to get coverage or don't want to spend the money. I mean, there are surely some people like that. But a lot of the people, most of the people who don't have health insurance would like to get health insurance if they could afford it, if it was made available to them. But it's just not.
Jonathan Cohn is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. His new book is entitled Sick, subtitled The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Call us. Hang on the line. We're going to get to you right after we take these messages at WOSU 820, your all-day NPR news station.
Where do you go for rich conversation on the topics that matter the most? The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. I'm Rebecca Roberts. Join Neil Conan for a provocative discussion of the issues you really care about. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is on only on WOSU 820 this and every weekday afternoon from 2 to 4. 10:30 is our time now on Open Line. Partly sunny skies forecast. There's a very slight chance of rain today, tonight, and tomorrow. It's a little warmer out there than we should expect for this time of the year, but we'll take it. 78 forecast for the next 2 days. 55 degrees overnight tonight. Could get some gusty winds when the rains come down, primarily sometime tomorrow and off and on tomorrow. 69 degrees now here at WOSU. Our spring membership drive gets underway over in the next few days, and you can still help make the drive even more successful than we know it will be by pledging your support ahead of the game now. 1-800-421-1717 is the number to do that. Of course, you can always go online to WOSU.org and follow the icons. And then when you do contribute your support ahead of time, we put that in our challenge fund. That's what we use during the drive once it begins to encourage everyone else listening to join. So you'll know that your pledge of support is in there. 1-800-421-1717.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderley. We're talking about our American health care system with more than 45 million Americans without health insurance. And even those of us who think we're covered, as we're finding out, may find that our policies don't cover all that we were led to believe. Journalist Jonathan Cohn is with us. He's a senior editor at The New Republic. His new book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. We're at 614-292-8513. Call us. Let's go right to you here. Charlotte is on the line. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Fred. This sounds like a vicious cycle to me financially, in the sense that I'm wondering what portion of that insurance company overhead for the corporation goes in as political contributions. Because I remember looking up on Public Citizen websites some years ago that among the top five donors to both political parties are the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. And then these turn around to be the very people who complain about those hideous trial lawyers and their $400 haircuts. And it sounds to me rather like one hand washes the other in this business, and the patient is the last consideration on anybody's agenda.
Jonathan, what do we know?
That's a great comment. You know, it's true. I mean, the interests that benefit from the status quo, and insurance companies certainly benefit, the pharmaceutical industry certainly benefits, they spend a lot of money and a lot of time to prevent changes from happening. I think that is going to be the case. Any kind of universal health care plan is going to inspire a lot of opposition. You know, we're getting to sort of the political question now. How do you do this? What's interesting about this to me is that there's sort of two schools of thought. I mean, there is, you know, in Washington, you can go two ways on this. You can try to come up with a health care plan that won't offend all of the interests in the hopes of co-opting some of them, and you can do that. Or you can try to really build up the support for universal health care and overcome that opposition. Ideally, I should think you would like to do both, and more of the latter than the former. And the reason I say that is that one of the great lessons of the 1990s, you know, the Clinton health care plan, people often forget, but it was designed to be something that a lot of special interests would like. And in fact, if you go back to it, the large insurance companies, for example, would have done just fine. They would have had guaranteed business. And the large insurance companies, in a lot of ways, aren't necessarily as problematic as the small ones, because the large ones, they like stability, they like predictability. They're not the ones that tend to exclude so much people for pre-existing conditions. But, of course, when the time came to pass the plan, the large insurance companies, it's not like they lifted a finger to help it either. They were happy to let it happen, but they didn't really try. And meanwhile, the small insurance companies were the ones that fought so hard. And they gave us the famous Harry and Louise ads that were so instrumental in bringing down the Clinton health care plan. I think that's a reminder that while you can work with some interest groups to get them to go along with universal health care, at the end of the day, a lot of them are going to fight. They will fight very hard. They do have a lot of money. And that's why if you're looking ahead to, say, the next presidential election and the term that comes after it, universal health care, it's not going to pass unless somebody really builds a mandate for it, unless there's really a public outcry for it. It's not enough just that people like the idea. They have to really want it.
Okay, yes. Charlotte? Thanks for your questions.
Thank you.
And here's Arlene. Hi, Arlene. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you, gentlemen, for such an important program. I would like to have Mr. Cohn comment on a single-payer strategy, which we in Ohio are working very hard with initiative petition, Health Care for All Ohioans Act.
I would love to comment on single payer, just to give every your listeners a definition. Single payer, the idea of what's called single payer health insurance, the basic concept is that the government becomes in effect, it gives everybody, it becomes the insurance company. It becomes the single payer of health bills in the country. It's not necessarily literally true. You can construct a single payer system where the government operates through three or four or a series of nonprofit intermediaries or what have you. But the general idea is that the government now becomes the insurer. There can still be private insurance in some of these schemes as a supplemental policy on top of it. The easiest way to explain single-payer health insurance for Americans is to say that Medicare is a single-payer health insurance program. That's exactly how Medicare runs. The government gives everybody their basic health insurance, and then people can buy supplemental insurance to cover what Medicare doesn't. I like single-payer health insurance. I think the case for single-payer health insurance is very strong. I am continually disappointed that in American politics it doesn't get more attention. I'm curious to see whether that changes in this presidential cycle. Now, I will say the one place where I tend to differ, the people who favor single-payer often, I know some of them, they tend to think that anything that is not single-payer is not worth doing, in effect. That there are some single-payer advocates for whom it is single-payer or nothing. And I wouldn't put myself on that camp because I think that anything that gets us to real universal coverage is a dramatic improvement over what we have now. And you can always fix it later on. You can always build it to a single-payer system. But single-payer systems, I mean, they are more efficient. They are easier for beneficiaries. Again, I think the best proof of this, the two things I would cite are, number one, the most popular insurance program in America is Medicare. It is more popular with its beneficiaries than any private insurance program. And number two, it is more efficient. Again, we were talking about the medical loss ratio, the amount of money spent on things other than health care. For the commercial industry, you're talking 20, 30, even 40% in some cases. For even for nonprofit insurers, you know, what we consider good insurers, the best are at 8 or 9 or 10%. Well, in Medicare, the overhead is 2 or 3%. That is 97% of the money that goes into the program comes back out as medical care. Now, it is not a perfect program. It has problems like all insurance programs have problems. But of the models out there, I do think it's the best. I would very much like to see it part of the discussion. And if I were king for a day, particularly if I could go back and travel in time, I would go back to 1933 when we first created our modern health insurance system, and I would tack on a single-payer system to the Social Security Act. And frankly, we wouldn't have most of the problems we have now.
Arlene, you're part of a group that's trying to get something called the Health Care for All Ohioans Act on the ballot. Is that right? Would it work something along the lines,
yes,
Jonathan is suggesting?
Yes, that's correct. To keep our private medical providers and have the single-payer system, which would cover everybody. We say everybody in, nobody out, regardless of the pre-existing conditions. And information is available on the web at www.spanohio.org or by calling 216-736-4766.
And Arlene, you're collecting signatures right now?
That is correct.
Okay. In the effort to get it on what ballot?
And
which ballot, Arlene?
As soon as possible. As soon as possible by 2010 or earlier, if we can get all those signatures.
Okay, well, we'll have to have somebody from your organization and somebody who is opposed to what you're doing on the air and have a debate. Thanks for your call.
Can I add one very quick question?
Yes.
She made a really good point that I can't stress enough. You know, people talk about single-payer health care, and they think socialized medicine. It's not. Doctors continue to practice in private. Hospitals are still private, except for the ones that are already public. It's just the insurance function that the government is taking over. It is not socialized medicine, which I think is a very radioactive word in American politics. It was such a good point she made. I wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah, Jonathan, under single-payer, now what happens to the private insurance companies? I never think they're going to go out of business, right?
Well, you know, there is that. Again, it depends on how you structure it, though. I think a lot of, again, the large insurance companies, I think, could make peace with a system where they were providing the supplemental insurance. And I'm also not against, again, if you're thinking about recreating the Medicare program, well, you know, Medicare has an option where you can enroll in private insurance if you prefer. And I'm not against a system where there's some kind of competition allowed, as long as it's controlled and regulated in the right way so that the private insurance industry doesn't have an unnatural advantage in this. There's actually a plan out there. Speaking of plans, you know, there's a plan by a professor at Yale named Jacob Hacker, who has studied this a lot. And I like his plan a lot, and you can Google him on the web and find his plan. But it's called Medicare for All. And the general idea, it's kind of a stepping stone to single payer. And what it basically does, it says it creates a Medicare option that anybody can enroll in. And so it sets up a sort of natural competition. And it requires everybody to get health insurance, but it says if you can't get insurance on your own, or your employer doesn't provide it, or if you're an employer and you're sick of paying private insurance and premiums, you can get people directly into Medicare. And over time, if more and more people enrolled in Medicare, well, eventually you would basically get a single-payer system. But it would have to win itself. It would have to essentially win out in a competition, which I think appeals to a lot of people who think maybe single-payer is a good idea, but I'm not 100% sure, and I don't want to change everything right away. So it's a nice middle ground, and I'm waiting for one of the presidential candidates to pick up on it. Senator John Edwards has a plan that's kind of a not too distant cousin from that, but I'd love to see somebody really pick it up.
But in this one, they'd have to compete with the private insurers for best price, best coverage, et cetera.
Right. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, I happen to think that Medicare wins that battle hands down if it gets a fair shot.
All right. Back to our callers. Winnie is next. Hi, Winnie.
Oh, hi. A couple of things. First, I'd like to know if you agree with me that a lot of this socialized medicine bravado began with physicians during the, you're probably too young to remember, but during the 50s and the 60s. Talk shows at that time were full of doctors who were screaming about socialized medicine. So, you know, that's what the American public heard, and it was anathema to doctors. However, I happen to be in on programs when Medicare first came in, and because I worked in the industry, I was the person who had to go to the seminars and so on and learn how this was going to work. Well, and I worked in the medical profession all day, and of course, what the doctors did was at that time, the you know, good internist, his office calls were probably $15. Well, as soon as they knew Medicare was coming in, they raised their office calls to $25. Because they knew that Medicare was only going to pick up the 20% and so on and so forth. I mean, they designed their payment plan, their fees, so that they used Medicare.
Sure,
Jonathan, to their benefit. Now, I want to know why couldn't we have a Medicare program? For instance, I think that one you just spoke about joining Medicare. As a non-medic, I guess you mean you don't have to be 65 to join that?
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, that would be
right?
Jacob Hacker's plan, right?
Right. I mean, the idea of the Jacob Hacker plan is to open Medicare to everybody, not just the over 65 population. And, you know, when people talk about single-payer plan, I mean, the easiest way to explain single-payer plan is say, we will give everybody Medicare. Doesn't matter how old you are. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the idea behind a single-payer plan. I want to go back to the history because she's exactly right. Historically, in fact, the single most important source of opposition to universal health care has been the physician community. The story goes that in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt thought long and hard about adding national health insurance to the New Deal, and he was very concerned that state medical societies would rise up and oppose it. And he was concerned that not only would they defeat national health insurance, but he was worried they would actually manage to undermine the entire Social Security Act, and he wasn't willing to take that chance. This is the story in the history books, at least. So, and that's why we didn't get national health insurance in the 1930s. And that was definitely true up through the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And, yes, that's where the socialized medicine charge began, I think. I mean, it had been other people had used it also. And certainly you see it sort of high watermark, I would think, in the late 40s when Harry Truman tried to do universal health care. And then again in the 1960s during the Johnson administration. What's interesting about this is that in just the last 20 to 30 years, I think, the medical community has started to undergo something of a transformation, and I attribute that partly to the influence of managed care. I think a lot of physicians, having dealt with HMOs and having dealt with private insurance bureaucracies, have come to the conclusion that, you know, this isn't really much better than dealing with the government, and in fact, in some ways, it's worse. It's a slower payer. It interferes in my practice much more, frankly, than government does. I mean, government payers tend to be, the reimbursement rates tend to be less, but there's less day-to-day interference in the way you conduct your medical practice. So you do see a sort of shift. You know, you no longer talk about doctors as the sort of number one source of opposition to universal health care. And in fact, if you start to break it down within the medical community, you'll find there are a lot of pockets where there are physicians who actually favor universal health care. My father actually favors universal health care, and he is a physician. And I can tell you that particularly among primary care doctors, you see that more than surgeons, you know, pediatricians, general practitioners, family doctors, psychiatrists, some OBGYN. I think because in part they are close to the ground, they deal with their patients over time, and they see how the lack of health insurance and the volatility of our insurance system affects these patients, they tend to be a little more favorable towards universal health care. I mean, the groups representing pediatricians and general practitioners, again, for some time now, have been very vocal advocates, not just of universal health care, but in some cases of single payer, which is really, you know, what I would consider the most progressive alternative out there. So the medical community used to be the big source of opposition, not so much anymore. Now you get it from other quarters, although there's still plenty of doctors out there who do talk about socialized medicine and are absolutely opposed to universal health care.
Mm-hmm. Winnie, thanks for your call. My guest, Jonathan Cohn, is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. His new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan, before we get to our next caller, there's another piece I wanted to get in here because we talked about how hospital emergency rooms are not an efficient way of delivering health care services to people and don't get those services to people. But then people say, look, you got Medicaid, which is a government program for the poor and the disabled. The problem with that is, as you point out, there have been big cutbacks on the state level in Medicaid services, right?
Right. I mean, Medicaid, the old saying, you know, in politics is that programs for poor people tend to be poor. Medicaid, in some ways, has done heroic work. It is responsible for covering all sorts of people. If we didn't have the federal Medicaid program, the number of people without health insurance would be much, much higher. But the problem is that it has never been funded adequately to deal with the demand for it. It's never covered all of the people who could get who need health care who are too poor to afford it on their own. And it has never been given adequate administrative funding to run this kind of program. And so you end up in this situation where the program has at times expanded, but it hasn't expanded fast enough to take up all the added demand. And then what ends up happening is that to further complicate the problem is that Medicaid is run by the states. Now, state budgets tend to fluctuate with the economy. So in good times, the states have a lot of money. Bad times, the states don't have a lot of money. Well, the problem with Medicaid is it's precisely when you're having the bad times that you need Medicaid the most. It's during the slack economy that you have more people unemployed, more people who need help with their health insurance, and yet that is exactly the time that the states don't have extra money to put into Medicaid. So you do have this spectacle frequently where at times of the greatest needs, states are cutting back on Medicaid. And you can cut back on Medicaid in all sorts of different ways. I mean, you can limit enrollment. You can pay less to the people who are providing Medicaid services. You can cut the reimbursement to doctors and hospitals. Now, that may not seem like a cut right away, but I can tell you that once that happens, the doctors and hospitals will see fewer Medicaid patients. So it means longer waits for the Medicaid patients. And then you can do all sorts of backdoor sneaky stuff. I mean, it's well known in the policy community that if you want to cut your Medicaid rolls without saying you're going to cut your Medicaid rolls, what you do is you just increase enrollment enforcement. You ask people to file for their eligibility more frequently. Well, you know, if you're having to file every 2 or 3 months, there's a lot of people who are going to get confused, and a lot of people will get caught up in, for no fault of their own, in bureaucratic mishaps, and they'll end up dropping off the Medicaid rolls. And I cannot tell you the number of times I've interviewed people who say, I was on Medicaid, I thought my Medicaid continued, I got to the hospital, they said I wasn't eligible, I didn't have Medicaid anymore, or I got to the doctor's office and I wasn't eligible for Medicaid, they didn't have Medicaid anymore, by the time I got it back, I owed a new hospital bill, and now I'm not going to see the doctor. This happens all the time. So you have this situation where this program that has done enormous good, I mean, thank God we have Medicaid and thank God for the people who support it, and yet, frankly, is not big enough to handle the demand and is not a good vehicle for covering all the people who don't have health insurance.
So I guess it's safe to say, because of the Medicaid cutbacks at the state level, that there are people in Ohio and people in other states who need life-saving drugs, can't afford them and are not getting them and will suffer, perhaps fatally suffer because of that.
It's not safe to say. It's fact. I have a story like that in my book that focuses on Tennessee. And it's a classic example, too, of the way the Medicaid program works. Tennessee was very ambitious in the early 90s, really tried to reach out to a lot of the people in the state who didn't have health insurance by expanding its program. They called it 10Care, and making more people eligible, even people who weren't so poor, just because maybe they were working and they didn't make a lot of money and they had pre-existing conditions, whatever. And then the state, the budget got tight, and they ended up cutting it back. And I tell the story of a couple who was dependent on those expansions to cover their prescription drugs. And once the coverage cut back, well, they cut back, and they do what so many people do. They just started rationing their own medication. You know, there's this myth you hear often. We don't want to have universal health care because we might have to ration our health care. Well, I have news for you. We ration health care in the United States all the time. People in America are constantly rationing their own medications. And sometimes they're splitting pills, and sometimes they're not getting pills at all if you're talking about pharmaceuticals. And in the story I tell, a family, a couple, a man with a number of different disorders whose medications was really keeping him going, basically stops taking them, and a few weeks later he actually ends up dying. Now, would he have died anyway? It's impossible to know. But the people around him, the people who took care of him, said once he left those medications, his whole demeanor changed. He was worried. It was both an emotional thing, but also a physical thing. He had less energy. His health seemed to decline. And they really do think that if he had been on that Medicaid program for a while longer, he would have lived longer, and those last few months and last few years would have been a lot more pleasant for him and for his family.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, the single-payer program you discuss and you advocate, the Medicare for All type situation, can we really afford that? I mean, if states are struggling now under the benefit of Medicaid, which insures some poor people and some disabled people but keeps others off the rolls, can we afford everybody under a Medicare program? And isn't Canada having an awful lot of problem with just that right now?
Well, the most important thing to remember is when you talk about can we afford a new healthcare system, you need to look at the whole healthcare system. Remember, we pay for everybody's healthcare, and one way or another, we all pay for it. One of the crazy things about our system is that money gets passed around, and you're not even sure where your money is going. I have private health insurance from my employer, but some of that money I pay is hidden money, that is higher charges that the hospitals are passing along to me because they're having to take care of people who come in who are not insured. At the end of the day, every other country with universal health care pays less than we do. We pay more than any other country in the world for our health care system when you add up all the money we spend from private and public insurance. So we're paying all this extra money, and yet we're not getting anything for it, if you believe the evidence. First of all, again, every other country covers everybody with insurance. We have 45 million people without health insurance. So start right off the bat there. But then even if you look at the actual quality of Medicare, the evidence doesn't suggest we're really getting a lot for that extra money. Other countries with universal health care manage to produce the best of what we have. They have high-quality care. They have easy access to doctors, free choice of doctor and hospital, et cetera. And yet they do manage to pay less. Now, I wouldn't necessarily put Canada in that category. Canada's system, for various reasons, doesn't seem to work as well as some of the others around the world. But even Canada's system, you know, you were saying, well, look, they're having trouble affording it. Yeah, they're having trouble affording it because they think they're paying too much. But they're paying less than we are. They're at 11, 12% of GDP. We're at 16, which is another way of saying that basically they're paying 11% of their national income on health care. We're paying 16%. So if they're maybe they're having problems, they think they're spending too much, but they're spending far less than we are. We're the ones with a healthcare spending problem, and the fact that we have this fractured system with all this waste in it is a big part of the reason why.
Let's get back to our callers. Callers, be concise, and we'll get to as many of you as we can before we close. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. As I understand Medicare, the government pays a specific predetermined amount for services rendered by private physicians. But we've got a single-payer government system now, the VA system, with clinics and hospitals set up so that we know by analysis exactly what it costs to run and provide a specific service. And I was wondering if we could use the VA system to ease our way in, maybe on an experimental basis in a region, but to ease our way into broader-based national health care. I'm thinking that since we know exactly what it costs to run the VA system, then without the overhead of insurance companies, corporations, that we can say this is the amount that it costs for this procedure, and you can either go to a government clinic or we'll pay this much to your private physician, then you can either have supplemental insurance or pay the difference if you choose.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, it's funny. You know, the VA, the great joke about socialized medicine is that the best medical care in America may be through the one socialized system we have, which is the VA. There's a lot of new information out now to suggest, and there's a book by a man named Phil Longman, which is worth checking out if you can get it on Amazon, that talks about the VA and what great care they give there. I think the cornerstone, the part I know best at least, is they have a terrific information sharing system. They do great record keeping. And if you know anything about medicine, both in terms of the virtues of collaboration and the propensity for error in a fractured system, having that information is a great tool. So the VA does give very good medical care. I'd say as a sort of long-run picture, I have a hard time imagining Americans. I mean, American culture likes private initiative. I have a hard time imagining all of us ending up in government clinics like the VA. But using the VA as a model certainly is something we can do. And I think it also, again, is a reminder that when it comes to healthcare, it is not the case that the private sector is always better than the public sector. In fact, with healthcare, I believe in private enterprise. I like capitalism. It's great for 99.9% of the things out there. But when it comes to healthcare, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the government just does it better.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for your suggestions today. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, gentlemen. Just wanted to comment that most people don't know the difference between payment and charges. In other words, I worked for an organization, which I will not name, years ago, and got to see from the physician side the variability in just a single specialty in terms of what they charged against the background of what Medicare would reimburse. And the variability charges was between about 122%, 125%, and over 300% of Medicare allowable. Meaning that if you're some poor schmo like me and you go into the hospital and you need this, that, and the other service and you have no insurance whatsoever, you may pay literally triple the amount that a Medicare patient would end up paying. And there are some people, I would be one, who would try to bargain, would say, hey, I'll pay you what Medicare would pay you. And some specialties and certainly some hospitals will work with you on that kind of basis. Others simply will not.
Yeah, I think, Jonathan, you pointed that out earlier in the program. Huh?
Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, there is this crazy charge system where it's sort of like a bazaar where everyone's bargaining prices all the time, except that you don't see the bargaining. So it happens invisibly, and there is this ridiculous perverse irony where the people who don't have health insurance are the ones who end up paying the most because they don't have insurance companies bargaining down. And it's a self-fulfilling cycle, too, because the way this works in the bargaining is fascinating, is that the hospitals say, okay, we're charging so much, and the insurance company says, the hospital says, I'll charge $200 for this procedure. Insurance company says, if you want our patients, you have to discount that to 100, 180. Hospital says, fine. And the next day, the hospital says, we'll raise our prices to 220, and then because the insurance company discount is based on a percentage, so they'll pay more, and then the insurance company says, aha, you raise your prices, we want a deeper discount. Well, the result is that the charges keep getting higher, higher, and higher, but the payments don't, and you get this huge gap, and you do it. And three times as much is not unheard of. That's entirely possible. You could pay three times as much as somebody with insurance for a procedure just because you're paying, again, like what I would say, the sticker price.
Paul, thanks for your comments. John is here. Hi, John.
Yeah.
Quickly Hello. Now.
Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, am I on the air?
Very quickly now. Go ahead.
All right. You speak so despairingly about our care system. What system in the world is as good as ours? Not only for research, product development, drug development, and care, and intensive care. I have a situation whereby in this past year, I've had another cancer surgery, successful, third time, all other two times successful. I had to take radiology treatments, all successful. I suffered a slight stroke, and also carpal tunnel, and also a vestibular problem. That's all in the last year. I'm 80 years old, and by golly, I'm still kicking like a madman. And I was in London this past fall, and the London Times showed a nice picture in the front page. Welcome to our healthcare system, where a woman went in there with a hysterectomy, with a bunch of guys in there with prostate operations. Now, you tell me, please, you're just knocking the daylights out of the system. Yes, every system has problems, but you tell me you cherry-pick the bad And a woman in Florida, I was in a car, we were listening.
Well,
to
we have to, I'm sorry to interrupt, John, but we have only 1 minute left, and Jonathan, 1 minute to answer.
I'm going to fly right through this. The statistics show that it depends on what kind of, first of all, I'm glad you're doing well. The statistics show that it really depends on what kind of cancer you're talking about and what kind of treatment. There are cancers where Japan is better than the United States. There are cancers where France is better than the United States. They have more technology in Japan than we do here in the United States. In France, they get more time with their doctors than they do. I talk about France and Germany, Switzerland and Japan as the ones that I think offer what I think most Americans would consider the high-quality care. Britain does not. Now, that's because Britain spends so little, and I don't hold out Britain as a great example. But if there's not, it is absolutely the case that you can have universal health care, you can cover everybody, and give the same high-quality care you have here in the United States without waiting lines, without sacrificing the high-tech care, without sacrificing the equipment, and without sacrificing what's good, if that's what you think is good, about American medical care. There's a myth that you can only get these great treatments in the United States, and it is simply not true.
All right, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic, new book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People That Pay the Price. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. This has been great.
Andrew Bartschmuck, the next on WOSU 820 AM Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org.